it was going to be, whether it was good or bad, it was going to be, you know, negative towards him. So the third thing they found was that, and this was no surprise to anybody, that the data that they had was pretty spotty. The data that, meaning race and ethnic data. So, and lastly, what they also found was that once they got to sentencing, there was a disproportionate representation of racial and ethnic minorities in the criminal system. So that was, you know, some of the highlights of that original task force. So where are we currently? So we still are dealing with issues of trust and confidence in the courts. But right now that's kind of on a grander scale. Like if you consider the current cultural zeitgeist, most folks don't trust institutions. And when you add the layer of race and ethnicity, it compounds to that lack of trust. The other thing that we're currently dealing with is that perception of bias still remains. So what are we doing about that in the Office of Fairness and Accountability? We hired a public outreach coordinator to engage these communities in a two-pronged approach. One is outreach, genuinely, you know, doing outreach to these communities, because there's that historical lack of trust. What we're doing right now is we're just showing up and saying we're here. We're showing up to community partners' board meetings and just introducing ourselves, saying, you know, we're here if you need us. Again, because we haven't really engaged them, you know, that trust isn't there, so we don't want to go in guns ablaze and saying, here we are, you listen to what we got to say. We're just, you know, earning their trust. The second thing is we are doing an education outreach, a civics education outreach, working with high schools and saying, you know, here's how the court system works. Here are some of your resources that the court has available to you, because again, a lot of what's happened is, you know, there is that lack of education, and that lack of education adds to that mistrust, because, you know, they don't know how the system works. So when you don't have that knowledge, you tend to mistrust what's going on. So one of the things that we're doing is not just working with high schools, but we're also partnering up with community-based organizations on this civic education outreach. So that's one of the things that we're doing to address that component. And this, so the other, and this is where I wanna, you know, mainly focus on, is the data. Our data is still unreliable, with one exception. On the juvenile side, our data is pretty reliable, mainly because we have more points of entry for data. We have, you know, social workers, schools, caseworkers, probation officers. So there's more points of entry where we can receive true and accurate data. On the district side, the data comes in through law enforcement or some of you prosecutors. And with law enforcement, every law enforcement agency has a different protocol on how to enter this data. Some don't do it at all, and some have different markers. So and when they do it, it tends to be whatever the perception of the officer is. So what he thinks the person is, that's what they answer. So it's not a self ID. So that's why, you know, the data is kind of, you know, spotty. So here's how we are hoping to address this. So we are starting, and this data has always been our roadblock, because we recognized that there was that racial and ethnic disparity, but because we didn't know who was who, we couldn't really address that disparity before it got to that point. So here's how we are getting around that roadblock. We are partnering up with a couple of professors from the U, Professors Mishras. They're husband and wife team, and what they're doing is that they're using quantitative modeling to clean up our demographic data. What qu- quantitative modeling is it's a series of algorithms that's used by law enforcement agencies, including Department of Homeland Security, other federal agencies, including Department of Transportation, health agencies, and what they do. And I will send to you, I think I sent to some of you this already, is a description of how quantitative modeling works. I asked the professors to give me a description where non-academics can understand it, because the first time I was they explained it to me, I was like, I took stats twice in college, right? So I can share this with you. But what the algorithm does is it looks at folks' name, address, and census information, and a couple other markers, and they run this algorithm, and with a 97% accuracy, they can identify folks' race and ethnicity. So we, with that, we can now see who is who on our records. What we will also do, again, because we recognize the limitations of this, is we are going to cross-validate with their work with the Pew Foundation and with CJARS, which is the Center for Judicial Records, and they work with several state court systems on projects similar to this. So now that we know who's who, then what? We are putting together a group of stakeholders, including the Indigent Defense Fund, CCJJ, APMP, law enforcement, OOMBA, district court judges. And what we're doing is we're looking at the criminal adjudication process in a linear way, and this group will identify different points along the process and data mine and see why is it that folks of color remain on this process and the dominant culture does not. So I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. When we start in this process, race and ethnicity matches up to our state demographics. So for example, I'll give you a data point that we do have that's pretty accurate. Utah's 1.5% African American. And when we start, this matches to the population. By the time we get to sentencing, folks that in jails and prisons that identify in this demographic make up 8.5% of the population. So what that tells us is that, because if you're looking at it linearly, what that tells us is that because you can't come in halfway through the line, everyone starts out the same with a probable cause statement, what that tells us is that folks tend to drop off, folks in the dominant culture drop off, and folks of color don't drop off, they continue to grow, and that's why this disparity grows. So what this group will do is look at these points, and now that we know who's who, examine the why. What happens that causes certain groups to not drop off and other groups to continue on? So because this is a systemic problem, we're bringing in the whole community to address this. That's why we're asking all these groups to be part of this project.
Can you back up? I didn't understand that data explanation. Are you saying that everybody enters the criminal justice system more or less at the same rate?
On par with the state's demographics.
That anecdotally does not seem even remotely accurate to me, but I don't know that.
And again, this is why we want to clean up this data and see why is it that when we get to jail and prisons, African Americans and Latinx community are overrepresented drastically as opposed to when we're starting. And here's where we're seeing this also, Jeff. because on the juvenile side, we have pretty accurate data, what we do see there, and we can track this, and they've already done this, is they do see that those that identify as white or Caucasian do drop off, and those that identifying these other demographics don't.
When you say drop off, I'm not sure what you
so
mean.
So there's, you know,
in
the system, like they get probation or they get, you know, another form of, you know.
Go ahead. So is your anecdotal experience tell you that that disparity would probably exist at the beginning of the process too?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think
it's that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
It exists at the beginning. And I don't think there's a 7 times more likelihood that a Caucasian would not go to prison as someone of color, but that I don't know for sure. But I think we enter the system at a disparate number.
And go ahead.
This is something that I'm trying to get my head around. Because, you know, Jeff and I headed the same office, and these are people who don't take race into consideration when they make charging decisions or settlement decisions. I mean, I've seen that, you've seen that, right? But I had a BYU researcher come in at their request and research all of our sexual assaults over a 10-year period. Through Spillman and the whole, and what we found, and she was doing it, they were doing it for other reasons, but the racial issue, and this was all pre-George Floyd, it struck to her, and so she started looking at that. What we found was this. First off, if you were a woman in Utah County that reported a rape, went through the forensic exam, and expressed a desire to be prosecuted, to have the case prosecuted. 77% of those cases died at the police station. And only 23% of them made it to the county attorney's office. Which is troubling in and of itself, right? For lots of reasons. But of those 23% that made it to the county attorney's office, the defendants in those cases, 40% of them were people of color. And we looked at that and thought, okay, how does this happen, right? And we took it to our chiefs and at the round table, and that went about as well as you might expect it went. The problem isn't ours, right? I mean, but we do have to acknowledge that there's something, we just don't see what we don't see. And
how did they explain the 65%, is that what you said, of cases that never got sent to your office?
77%.
They said that they called a county attorney and quote unquote informally screened it. And so then we went back and said, okay, let's make a criteria for informal screenings. And it dropped it down to 73%. And really what we're finding is that this is a sexual assault issue, not a race issue, but people are making judgment calls at the police station whether they believe the victim or not, basically.
So I think this is where you see the value of this, right? Because at the courts, when we take the case, you know, judges say, this is what's been given to me, so it's not on me, it's on.
Right.
And what you're saying is like, it wasn't us, it's, you know.
Right, and so what we did, we said, we went to all the chiefs and we said, listen, whenever there is, we pitched it like, listen, we're gonna cover your butts here. I mean, whenever there is a report of a sexual assault, send it to us. So we can track it, so we know. So that we don't, only 1 in 6 women report a sexual assault anyway.
Yeah.
So if we're only getting 23% of the 1 in 6, we're not getting very many.
Yeah.
And they all, you know, and so with some exceptions, all the police departments now we have a code in Spillman that will now say, this is not charged, and we've sent it to the county attorney's office, and so we're tracking them from our end so that we can follow up and say, okay, what happens there? Because it's easy for us to say, well, it's them, not us.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a responsibility to figure out why it's not coming to us.
And this is what we want to do in this initiative, is bring, you know, all of the stakeholders and really have the whole community look at these points. And now that we know who's who, we can examine the why. Why is this happening? So this will be phase one, looking at the why. And sometimes when you ask, let's look at this point, you'll get an answer, and then you might say, you know, per the answer what we're finding, let's look at these other points also. Because we don't know what's there. It could be some low-hanging fruit, as, you know, these group might get counseled a week before this group, and that does a world of difference. Or it could be something more problematic, as, hey, this district really does not like folks that check this demographic box. Again, we don't know what we're going to find. But by bringing this group of stakeholders, we can really start going after the why. So that's phase one. Phase two is, once we have this data, then this group can give policy recommendations to the Judicial Council on what ways to address, you know, what we're finding. Now, again, this is us really going after, because we have seen the racial and ethnic disparity before, but we've never gone after the why, because we didn't know who was who. So now that we can get around this, we're going after the why. So this would be phase two, is going out, making those policy recommendations. Now, what we're doing simultaneously to this, the courts are really seeing this platform. They're kind of pushing this. It's the My Case platform. And what we're going to do there is we're going to ask folks to self-ID. So we can also establish a baseline to compare, you know, what the quantitative modeling is showing us, if it's, you know, if it's on par, and it's a good baseline. Yeah.
So on that issue, that brings up a critical point that we've addressed, and you've worked on this, and so has Will, who's on the phone, how to identify people racially, ethnically, religiously in the criminal justice system. And we had a legislator run a bill a year or two, Representative Judkins.
Yeah.
Trying to mandate that the prosecutors collect that data. And of course, you may not know, we're adamantly opposed to that, because we want to remove race from our decisions, not add it to our decisions. Dan is an advocate, I think, for the state ID process. Is that what you call it?
A state ID number?
Yeah, your office is pushing that, I believe.
I don't know that we're pushing it. It's something that's come up in the bail pretrial discussions, and it's come up with the...
What we're talking about is when a person enters a criminal justice system, to put one identifying number attached to that case and that person, so it can be tracked through the police, prosecutors, courts, jail, prison, whatever it is. That's another problem, is mixing all those up through the system. But at the entry point, if we can gather that data somehow, that would be ideal.
Yeah.
And I know the sheriffs aren't in love with that, or the police departments, but I would just, so you know, prosecutors, and I think I speak for, we don't want to be collecting that data. I don't want to ask someone as a prosecutor, what are you? Because that's red flag.
I think sheriffs are actually getting on board with that, because they recognize that there is not data being tracked, and their own booking process is going to be messed up.
So let me emphasize this. So on the My Case page, it's voluntary information. So when they're hovering their mouse and they hover over this question, a little box is going to pop up and explain to them why we're collecting that. So it's not that they have to do it, or else they can't move on to the next question. Is we're, and this is through what the National Center for State Courts, their best practices is, because they're pushing for this and collecting this data. And they said when it's voluntarily asked, they get enough critical mass for them to track patterns. So again, it's not, we're not asking prosecutors to ask, it's just when folks go in and see, you know, where their next hearing is, what's been filed, you know, this question will get a prompt, and then when they hover, they'll have an explanation, you know, telling them why we're asking this question. So it's completely up to them whether they check it or not. Now, what we're discussing here is, you know, we don't work in silos. So, you know, you mentioned how you work with the chiefs. So the data we have, the data we collect, the questions we ask with this group, we then can share it with you, our partners. So again, I only have purview of when the courts take the case till sentencing, and then it, you know, gets passed off. So however, we can have data, you know, before and after. So we can share this with you, and once you have that, you know, again, I'm not telling other institutions what to do, or that's up to them, but once we have that, you know, we'll can share that with you, and you can use it for trainings, you can use it for policy recommendations, whatever you feel can help you best work, you know, in the work that you're doing. So my ask is that you are part of this group, because prosecutors are a crucial component of this initiative. Anything that deals with, you know, access to justice, I completely understand and know that you are a key component in that access to justice piece. So once this group gets going, you know, our original ask is once a month. You know, we'll meet, we'll start looking at the data, we'll start looking at what points to look at, what questions need to be asked, because whatever recommendations we decide, you know, we want you to be a part of that, because you're a huge part of the system.
Are you asking that we appoint someone to be on the group?
So great question, yes, because what this person, this is what I've been asking all groups, whoever you appoint will be speaking to you, and whatever work the group is doing, my hope is that they then report back to you, hey, this is what we're looking at. So then you can say, wait, have you asked this question in this group? And then this person can then go back and say, you know, hey, let's look at this other, ask other questions. Again, this model that we're presenting is a genuine outreach model where we work as true partners. So whoever you appoint, and with these other groups, I let them choose whoever they want to send. In a way, it's kind of your ambassador and a little bit of your advocate to say, you know, let's make sure we're asking these questions and we're looking at these points. So I know it's a time commitment. You know, right now all I'm asking is a 2-hour a month time commitment. If the group then decides, hey, we might need a little more time, that's up to the group, but right now that's what we're...
So are you looking for two prosecutors? Because you've got the prosecution counsel, and we're responsible for the training aspect, and SWAP has joined us, and they're more of the lobbying, legislative, kind of more of a voice for prosecutors.
More
policy stuff. Do you want one from each group or just one?
One from each group.
Okay.
And if you can send two, then
can I suggest we forgot to do that, Bob? We do an urban and a rural.
Yeah.
Because that's a different demographic in Utah to a certain extent.
You can decide who you send. If that's how you want to work it.
Does it make sense to send a prosecutor, or does it make sense to send a statistician who's familiar with the prosecution?
Then we're all out.
CJRs who are statisticians familiar with the system that are going to be examining this. But if you want to send a prosecutor and a statistician, I'm okay with that. But it's again, this is a true engagement. I hope you send someone that can really.
What's your time frame?
Our hope is that we begin late October, mid-November. So the way I'm thinking right now, the phase one should be pretty a lot faster, because you're just picking points and the professors are the ones doing all of the data mining. Phase two is where, you know, that's where the sausage gets made, because once you get the data, then you're coming up with policy recommendations. And every agency, I'm sure, has, you know, the nature of the beast has their own agenda and questions and what they want to recommend. So, yes.
Is the legislature involved?
So, again, separation of...
And I assume, I have one question before you answer that. The study was commissioned by the AOC, or was it a state legislative?
This is AOC.
James, because they have a hard time hearing in the back. James was just asking if this was a legislative issue or an AOC issue.
Yeah, legislators are involved in the process.
If the legislators are involved.
And then, who commissioned the study back in 96?
Back in 96, it was the Judicial Council, back in 96. And then once the report was done, they did present it to the Judicial Council and the legislature. I asked, what's his name? He was a former legislator. Like, he told me, like, yeah, we had to make a bunch of cuts in 2002, and this is just one of the things that was cut. But going back to this project, yeah, that's what we're asking right now, is that 2 hour a month.
Who from the legislature is involved?
So right now, this initiative is just judicial, the judicial branch. Once we have... But we're working through Tom Ross and CCJJ with this project, and whatever information that, and again, I only have purview of when the courts take the case till they release it. Any other information we get, we will give to CCJJ, because they're the broader policy institution, and they can do with that information what they feel is more wise.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Jonathan, Bob and I will work in getting those appointments to you, unless you want to swap to do whatever you want to do, Bob.
Yeah, no, I mean, council members, I don't know, do you want to discuss now, or do we want to do it via email, or is there a council member that wants to volunteer for that? I'm wondering if, I like your suggestion of rural and urban.
Yeah.
David, who's your statistician?
Her name's Alyssa Brown. She's a statistics grad that we just hired.
Okay.
And I'd be happy to, offer her time.
Anyway, council members, is there anybody that would want to volunteer?
In regards to the statistician, I think they're helpful, but I think it may be useful to have a practitioner that participates with her. Mm-hmm. She could come along, obviously, but...
Yeah.
Would be helpful. I assume you're not going to turn away people joining those meetings or listening in.
Most of our meetings are public, so I don't know a lot of folks that enjoy just, if they don't have to be in meetings where we're discussing policy and stats, but if they want to be there,
we're all geeks here, right?
Jeff, what's that guy, Brady Ames?
Let's not open that can of worms.
The powerful thing about having a practitioner is that they're boots on the ground. Like, they know, like, hey, this is what we're seeing, this is what, what we're experiencing. They have that anecdotal knowledge, and that can be combined with the data, the evidence. But it's up to you, this council. And before I'm done, let me tell you that the disparity, this recognizing disparity, I recognize that it's not the bedrock. It's just a symptom of larger systemic issues that the OFA and the AOC are looking to address. So we're working on other projects, but I hope that you recognize that change doesn't happen overnight, but together we can start chipping away on that. If you have any questions, my email is Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, Jonathan P, @utcords.gov, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Should we switch?
Yeah. So, council members, we're still in council meeting. Like I said, is there anybody that wants to volunteer for that? Or maybe Jeff and I can talk offline, and maybe we come up with somebody that we would suggest.
Swap will do it offline.
Okay.
I would suggest that we find a prosecutor of color. I think that would be the most helpful thing.
Okay. Rob Van Dyke is suggesting that we find a prosecutor of color that might be able to participate with this, and that narrows it, which I don't think is a problem. I can think of just a couple. So what we could do that is,